Tereo Ererangi o Te Mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Marianne Stone and Morin Rat. We hope you had a good Easter and you spent the whole time reading.
And sunning, and you know, just loving and having a good time with your family.
Exactly. And so, to follow up, lots more books to add to your list of what must be read. I'm talking with Megan Nicol Reid, a writer and columnist. She's been up for many awards for her columns, but this is her second adult novel, and she really does know how to write an engrossing read. It's called Other People's Bodies. And
a journey into the dark heart of wellness culture.
Wellness culture, yeah. There's a very evil man in there. He sort of gets his comeuppance, but I don't want to give anything away.
No spoilers
at all. And then my other guest today is a poet who I've been a great fan of for many years, Helen Rickaby. She lives in Te Whanganui, Ātara. And this is her latest work. It's called My Bourgeois Apocalypse. And it's a memoir come essay come journal. It's like...
Great title, Bourgeois Apocalypse.
Yeah, it will draw you in.
Excellent. And then I speak with the author of Karen Holdham. It's her first, she's also an ex-journo, or probably a journo, but this is her first novel, and it's a historical novel called The End and the Beginning. It's very beautiful. It's really worth a listen. The End and the Beginning is the first published novel by Karen Holdham. Karen's a journalist by trade, so she's no stranger to writing. But for this manuscript, she won the Best Manuscript Prize when completing her Master's in Creative Writing at Auckland University. And we can really see why. The extraordinary storyline may have been a gift from history, but Karen's treatment of it brings the difficult themes from that history alive through characters we fear for and we cheer for as they face the brutal realities of war. The book reminds us, without ever preaching, that the lessons from that most brutal period of human history remain really relevant today. She joins me on Zoom for our interview this morning. Tēnā koe, Karen. Congratulations on a terrific first novel.
Kia ora. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, so this is based on a true story, but before we talk about that, can you just, and how you discovered the story, can you just sketch for our listeners the plot setup, the setting, and the main characters?
Great. Sure. So it's set in the final weeks of World War II and on the border of France and Germany. So if you imagine at this time, you have the Western Front is pushing on through, the Western Allies are coming west, the Russians are coming east, Germany has been bombed to smithereens, and it's an Armageddon, it's a period of Armageddon. And into this steps a boy, a 13-year-old boy called Max and his best mate, who decide that instead of fighting for Hitler, they're going to try to cross Germany and get home to the French border in a time of absolute chaos. Meanwhile, we have the story of Marguerite, who's Max's mum, who's French, and she is trapped inside Germany trying to reunite her family. So you have these sort of two perspectives and two stories told side by side of people from the border, from right on the border.
Fabulous. Thank you very much. The title and the premise of the book, The End and the Beginning, they really remind us how the roots of future conflicts lie and how we deal with the aftermath of wars, right? And I guess that was a bit of an inevitable theme, given that you found the story at La Chauvinerie. I'm not sure that I've said that right. La Chauvinerie. What took you there? And can you tell listeners about finding the story and about the wonderful unfolding of relationships as your research progressed?
Yeah, so I found I'll just tell it briefly because it's a long story as to how I actually stumbled upon the real story of Edmond Baton, whose journey this book is based on. But in essence, this was a boy who left a Hitler Youth training camp, which wasn't called as such. They were called Kinderlandverschickung, which were children's evacuation to the countryside. But basically, they took German youth and trained them up to be soldiers. And this was Hitler's big, one of his many missions was to create an army of children. And so I discovered the story of Edmund's being in this, of Edmund's journey through a German military cemetery that's actually in France, in Normandy, right up near the beaches from the D-Day landings. And Edmund had crossed the whole of Germany and got all the way to the border, very close to home, when in fact he got arrested and sent to a civilian internment camp in the centre of France. And in reading about this internment camp, where lots of people who died there ended up at this German military cemetery, I understood that this was one of the, you know, huge scandal post-war, at a time when France was preparing to stand in judgment at Nuremberg in the Nazi war trials. This kind of horror had occurred in its backyard, which was that this internment camp did not look after its civilian prisoners, and they were not well looked after at all.
Mm. And so, and it's sobering and awful, but the book isn't, everybody. So this history is sobering and awful. The book is definitely deals with that, but let me just reassure listeners, pick this book up. Because you will be moved in many ways. There's an enormous amount of research. There's deep history of the region and of the war in the novel, but it never veers into exposition. You do that extremely well, Karen, and the lived experience of the characters is how we find all this research. You know, it's very credible and very detailed. So thank you for that. Were you a scholar of this era and regional and the political history of this era before you wrote?
No, and I had to become one because I just didn't know enough. Like everyone, I've read a lot of books and fictions, watched a lot of films from the story. I've read several history books related to World War II because it is a fascinating period of history. But when it came to imagining a story, and essentially this is an imagined story because we don't have all the details of the journey, I had to do a lot of world building. And that switching from being a journalist to being a novelist was really tough because I had to just create a world, and I didn't have the words of the people I was interviewing or to kind of rely on. I had to create it. So that came about through a lot of reading, and that really, really helped. And of course, interviews with the family who were on the border, which I didn't actually answer your previous question properly. But yeah, I did need to learn a lot, and so that I could just immerse myself into this world. The view I took was that I will create an historical scaffold, and that is absolutely as accurate as I can make it. And from that, I'll hang an imagined story. And that became the way that I didn't let the sort of the truth and the facts of Edmond Baton's specific story hold me back as a writer. I needed that story to fly, the imagined story to fly. But as long as a historical framework was true and the events and the characters in the story were true to the themes and true to the time and the people and the place.
Yeah, well, congratulations. You've done that very well. I imagined it like the scaffold and then your imagined characters kind of working through, living their story in this historical scaffold, which is exactly as you kind of describe it. So, one of the things, so let's go back then, actually. Tell us about forming a relationship with Edmund's character, a family, the base for Max, his family. How did that happen?
That was super, and that was one of the happiest and most privileged sort of my experiences about this whole thing. So I found out about Edmund's story, and it was very brief. It was a very brief summary of what had happened to him. And I thought, well, that's enough. I'm going to write my first book, because that is a very strong idea for a book. And then, but the journalist in me could not help just going and doing a little bit of digging. And I just was astounded that within a week I had an email from a then, I think, 85-year-old Frenchman called Joseph Baton saying, voila, contact is made, how can we help? Wow. And he was Edmund's first cousin and childhood friend. He put me in touch with Lily, who was Edmund's sister, who was still alive on the other side of the border. And I was over there within 6 weeks interviewing them and just welcomed into their homes, a complete stranger and, let's be honest, a nobody in terms of literature, in terms of writing fiction. And they just opened up their homes and hearts and memories. And I was so privileged to be part of that and got to know them very, very well.
Extraordinary, extraordinary. And I think that feeling, the respect and the emotion of those relationships really informs the story very much. I love that the themes of populism and complacency and of the whole experience of war are told through point of view characters who are women and children. That's kind of like an observation about the impact of war in itself. It's a political statement that you've chosen those point of view characters. Was that your intention? Did you kind of do that deliberately to think about the impact on women and children, on civilians, on
I absolutely did. I mean, there's an image which I can show you. Unfortunately, your readers can't see it, but it's of a boy who is about Edmund's age. Oh. He's in his great coat. He's got his badges on, and he's just been arrested or captured in Berlin, where he's no doubt been fighting with suicidal fervor. But the expression on his face is absolute terror. He's crying. He's a 13-year-old boy, and he had a gun or whatever he had, a good grenade thrower is all they had. And it's not a game.
Mm.
And his death is all around him, and children all around him have died for their Führer. And I really, really wanted to explore the war experience on fascism and indoctrination and propaganda and its effect on children. And it was a diabolical plan that Hitler had. I did not realise how deep it went and how, in fact, just how successful it was until I read a book called School for Barbarians that came out in the mid-1930s and was a warning to the world that Hitler was creating an army of children. So I particularly wanted to look at the impact on children, because also their worlds came crashing down. Those who survived believed everything they believed right up until the final weeks of World War II, and then it imploded. Everything they understood to be true of the world, their superiority, the invincibility of their leader, their strength, their right to be better than everybody, was just demolished. Mm. And they had to rebuild themselves and their lives, and not everyone did it successfully. Mm. There were a lot of really, really damaged German people from that period.
From that, it would be very easy, even though we have a natural empathy for children, it would be quite plausible to, or hard, in fact, to create characters that we really strongly empathise with and care for and love. And you've achieved that really well. I want to talk about Marguerite in a minute, but can you tell us how the character of Tonya came to you? Just thinking of political and war history of the region, the impact on women and children, and how did Tonya arrive in the book, and what part does she play in the novel for you?
Yeah, I have to confess, I slightly cheated with Tonya because she is based on a real person who I adore. Her character, her courage, and she grew up under Russian communism. So she actually talked to me a lot about what it was like to be a child. And I remember her telling me about a piece of graffiti she wrote, she saw in a classroom where someone had carved a picture of Lennon, I think, into the desk, and she was just so horrified and afraid and just overwhelmed that someone would do such a terrible thing. So so I needed a character like her. I wanted to represent the enslaved women in Germany in the Second World War, because I don't think their stories are well enough told. Again, I met someone whose family came from Ukraine, and haven't they been through a lot? And in the village that this man's family came from, every year the Nazis would come and go to every household and take another kid, take another daughter, and take them to Germany, where they were going to be dairy maids or domestic servants or whatever. So I wanted that story to be told. And in terms of her character, well, Tonya is just a gift because I knew her.
Oh, well, it's a fabulous story, and it allows us to get close to the horror of women's experience in the war without you having to subject our point of view character, Marguerite, to that horror directly. She becomes sensitized through that relationship, and I think that's was very beautifully done. Marguerite reminds me very much of the mother from Paul Lynch's Prophet Song. Have you read Prophet Song?
I read it when he was at the Writers' Festival in Auckland. Right. I just finished, I had about three chapters to go, and I met him and I said, I fangirled him really badly. And it's like, oh, your book. And he was like, I'm really sorry, because he knew, of course, what was coming.
Ah.
But gosh, thank you. I mean, yeah, she is a great character. And I've never seen the comparison, of course, but there is, because mothers just endure, don't they?
But also, you know, that mother trying to keep a family safe, but permitting the creep and then the iron grip, then being in the iron grip of fascism and fascist control over a community, and Marguerite's character in that, you know, the notes of complacency, but then powerlessness, you know. So a comparison that came to me. Look, we're going to run out of time. There's a metaphor that you use on page 64. Have you got the book with you?
Oh, yes.
Okay, because this is just a really brief reading. There's a metaphor that you use. Marguerite's desperately seeking safety and survival for a daughter and herself in the employ of a German officer, and they're sitting down to a highly charged dinner full of threat and concealed power, and she watches a praying mantis crawling down a branch of blossom in a vase. And the very last paragraph of the top of page 64. Could you read that for us?
The mantis makes its slow passage along the length of a branch. Nothing for you out there, poor short-sighted creature, just a precipice hovering over a sea of knives.
It's fabulous. It's a fabulous metaphor for that, what happens if we ignore complacency. And so I thought that one was worth sharing.
Thank you.
It's just one tiny little example of great writing in a novel that's gripping, beautiful, and true. The book is The End and the Beginning. It's written by Karen Holdham. It's published by Simon & Schuster. It's available online or nationwide at bookstores near you. Thank you very much for joining us, Karen. And good luck. I can't wait to see what you write next. What are you working on?
Well, my next book opens in Taranaki in 1841 with a woman chained to a boulder, watching a couple of guys, including quite a hot Scotsman, build a gallows to hang her from. So I had fun writing that one.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so historical fiction, you've got the bug.
Accidentally, I do.
Accidentally, you do.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Number 33. I am no longer afraid of quicksand, but is that a mistake? I am waiting for something to happen, and I am feeling a bit poorly, like I'm getting a cold, though I'm hoping to fight it off, perhaps with the mulled wine I'm now drinking. There seemed to be a light shining. I think we are both offering each other something, but I'm not sure what. I had a coffee with O, which got me out of the house. Something I read recently on the internet, where someone was noting how out of proportion to reality the childhood fears of getting caught in quicksand and the Bermuda Triangle were to the actual threat. Maybe it was the yearning thing, the thing that takes the place of God. Studio Italiano da sette anni. I couldn't quite articulate it to myself yet, but I wanted to talk to him. I felt up for making dinner even. I like it when we don't have to shrink back from each other. Did SingStar especially enjoyed the rosemary? When you said you did understand me, I felt like you could see into my soul and all the secrets there were laid out for you. I kept thinking Spinoza was somehow going to be important in my exploration of doubt, but every time I read or listen to something about him, I am left with impressions, but few specifics. We did talk on the way down the stairs, and now I feel I probably should have been politer to everyone else, asked how they were, etc. Es and I went for a drive around the south coast, and because it was busy at Scorching Bay, we ended up at Polo and Miramar. Today, I want to keep journaling, and maybe I'll read, and maybe I'll do some gardening. I have weeds to pull out, and also plants to plant.
That was Te Whanganui Atara poet Helen Rickaby reading from her latest book, My Bourgeois Apocalypse. This is her fifth and a half collection of poetry. Well, she says that she's published four and a half, so maybe this, I don't know how the maths work there.
This is the fifth and a half.
Fifth and a half, exactly. the last time I talked to her was after she won the Mary and Peter Biggs Award for Poetry at the 2020 Ockham New Zealand Book Awards for her collection, How to Live. She's worked a lot in publishing and editing poetry journals, and we'll talk about that later, I hope. Helen, this is an extraordinary collection, and I gather that you had a launch come dance party for it, which kind of makes sense.
When I was thinking about how I wanted to launch this book, I thought, I have to have a dance party. There's a lot of songs mentioned in the book and a lot of music and dancing. And the period that this book covers, because it's a kind of a sort of a poetic memoir kind of thing, the time when dancing and music was particularly important to me, and also a time when you couldn't always dance with other people because that includes the lockdowns and the pandemic generally.
Yeah, it's taken from journals, what you were writing in your journals, shall we say, from 2019 to 2024. It's described as a collage slash essay slash memoir. I'm really interested in the process of your putting it together. What you took, how you laid it out, all those kind of things.
I mean, I guess the whole way through it was a bit of an experiment. It wasn't the book I thought I was writing. I am still writing, and it's about doubt. And so through this, there are some of my notes and thoughts about that. But I was having a lot of trouble with that book. And then an idea came to me from a few different inputs. I've been playing with randomness and chance in my writing a lot, and I've kept a journal since I was a teenager. My journals are not just diaries, though there is some of that. They're kind of repositories of everything, of all my thinking and notes, and all my drafts begin in my journals. So it's not, so there's a lot of different kinds of things in there. And I had this idea of what would happen if I took some randomly selected sentences from my journals and make a poem out of it. which I do make my poems out of sentences from my journals, but not usually with the element of randomness. And so I picked up some sentences and I arranged them in the way that had some juxtapositions and things that surprised me, and I liked it. And so then I did a few more, and then I thought, oh, this could be something.
This could work. Because it's the surprise for the reader as you go through it. You start off thinking that there's going to be some logical progression, and and then after about two or three, you think, hang on. There are threads coming through, obviously, but, you know, this isn't just a day-by-day progression. This is not necessarily chronological, which it is.
It's mostly chronological, but yeah. I like to think it's more poetic logic.
Yeah,
I think a lot about poetry and what it is and what it brings. I'm really interested in where poetry intersects with other forms. With Anna Jackson, I've run a few conferences about poetry and the essay, poetry and biography. The last one we did was kind of about hybrid works. So I'm really interested in what it is that poetry brings to other things. And I think it brings its layers and it brings a way of being able to leap over gaps and make connections that are not necessarily logical.
Yeah, and so there's work for the reader to do, but it's not onerous work. It's like...
Oh, good.
No.
I mean, when I was writing it, I was thinking, is anyone else going to like this? But then I showed some to various people, and they did like it. But I was a bit, I didn't show it to people as much as I would normally. Like I didn't show it to my husband until I had actually handed it in, because in case he didn't like what I was doing, I didn't want to be stopped.
No,
until I was done.
Yeah, or made conscious, you know, too self-conscious about what you were pulling out. Mm. I guess.
Yeah.
You didn't.
I mean, he has, of course, read it now, and he has, he's proved it. but sometimes you just have to try something and not be dissuaded, and then you can see what happens. And it's not going to be for everybody. I mean, one review, and the chat was a bit bamboozled by it, I think. And that's fair enough, because poetry's like that. Sometimes it's just not for you.
Yeah, I totally, kind of totally agree. Yeah. And, I read it twice, so I could go back and do more links or the other. Yeah, when I read it twice, I'm articulating what I'm thinking, obviously, which is not always sensible. But I think I allowed myself to enjoy it more the second time, because I wasn't trying too hard to work out what you were doing.
Yeah. I mean, I think, and for myself, having read poetry a little bit like this sometimes, you have to kind of go with it and just go with its flow. A book that I had been very inspired by for my last collection in particular, for one poem in my last collection, is a book called My Life by Lynn Hajinian. And somebody had loaned me that book a very long time ago, and I tried to read it several times, and I just couldn't. I just could not get past. I couldn't get into it. And then one day I opened it, and I was like, I can just flow with this. I don't need to, it's similar in that the sentences don't follow on from each other. Mm. And once I just accepted that and went with it, I could suddenly read it and loved it. But sometimes it takes a while to learn how to read something.
Oh, it sure does. And most people who enjoy poetry don't don't want to just have something served up to them that is immediately accessible.
No, although you do want to have something you can connect with reasonably soon.
Oh, yeah.
I guess you want, you want layers in poetry. You want it to maybe give you a little bit to start with, but then keep on giving you more.
Yeah, this, you know, as I say, it's described as a collage and that it's similar to found poetry in a sense. But also,
I've been describing it as self-pound poetry.
Yes. Yes, you've generated it. Your own AI, really, isn't it?
That did occur to me later. It's like I'm my own large language model, or maybe it's a small language model, but it is a little like that.
That's right. It's you've only, made
I hope,
it all.
I hope less waffly.
Oh, there's no waffle in it, I don't think, at all. That's what I enjoyed. There's no self-indulgence. You're not just filling up space on the page. And it was a particularly weird time, 2019 to 2024. Think of all the things,
strange things
that happened then. We were all interrogating ourselves and the world and the people around us, weren't we?
Yeah, it was very strange. I mean, the second poem, which is the first one kind of in chronological order, the first one's like a prologue, it begins in sort of around February 2019, and yeah, there's a few things in that poem about the Christchurch mosque shootings. And that was such a massive, surreal moment of horror. Like, this just doesn't happen here.
No.
But it did, and it was happening. And I guess there's been other things of a different nature through this whole time of, like, things that feel like a bad dream, but here we are in it, and now we're doing it. That's what we're doing now. Yeah.
Yeah, so the title is a very apt one, and, you know, without being trivial, the way that you've designed the cover, I know you would have designed it with somebody else, but all the things all the things that you've placed in the photograph on the cover, you know, are all there in the poetry. It's wonderful.
Yeah, they're all my things. I did a photo shoot. I got a friend of mine with a good camera to come and shoot it, but we arranged all of the things on my dining room table. And Auckland University Press was very indulgent, and the designer, Kaylee, did a great job with the photo to make it work as a cover.
Yeah, I don't always like to draw attention to the cover and not the contents, but in this case, you can't help it because it's so evocative of what's inside. And as you read through the poems and then you close the book, you think, oh, yeah, that's the green nail polish, the strange, is it a raptor something?
A roboraptor
who's sort of collapsed.
His name is Fluffy.
Ah.
I mean, I was, when I had the idea for a cover, I was inspired by Vanitas paintings, which were, I think, maybe 17th century, 18th century, mostly Dutch, I think. They're still alive, but they're kind of evocative of, like, death. And so they quite often have skulls in them, and I don't have skulls, and I didn't want to put a skull in it. But I thought, oh, well, the Roboraptor's head looks a little bit skull-like.
Yes. Yeah, it's a perfect still life. Helen, thank you for your time this morning. I've loved talking to you. I know you said to explain a poem is to take it apart like an equation that can be solved or a puzzle where the pieces fit, but I do not think poetry is like that. But I think you've done a really good job of of explaining how this book came about and what we can anticipate when we read it.
Oh, thank you.
The book is called My Bourgeois Apocalypse. It's by Helen Rickaby and it's published by Auckland University Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Megan Nicol-Reed wrote a much-loved and highly regarded column in national newspapers before turning her hand to fiction. Her first novel, One of Those Mothers, was a huge hit, and now we have her new book, Other People's Bodies to Enjoy. It's referred to in America as a sophomore novel, which I've always hated the sound of, but is it a novel for our times, do you think, Megan?
I would hope so. It was very much written as a reaction to our times. Although I say that and readers might kind of jump on it thinking that it's going to be hugely about kind of world issues, et cetera. And I think with my writing, what I always, my approach is always to kind of absorb what's happening on the world stage and politically, and then filter it through my observations and experiences and turn it into something quite personal. So, yeah, if that makes any sense.
Yes, of course, because, you know, a lot in this is about being taken in and manipulated and, you know, people having to try and work out what's true and what's not. But of course, female friendships are, you know, your forte, I think, aren't they?
I think so. Thank you. I'm flattered by that, because it's not like I set out thinking that that was my forte, but now two books into my writing career, it definitely feels like that's where my heart lies. That's what I'm interested in exploring.
There's five women and they've come together. Two of them know each other, have been childhood friends, but the others, they're all sort of disparate characters that find themselves in this rather, what would you call, I'm searching for the right word for Lars. He's charismatic.
Yeah, he is. I think he's charismatic, yet enigmatic, if I say that right.
Yes,
yeah, that's how I think of him. Funnily enough, my publisher didn't respond that well to him when I first filed the manuscript, and I think she had in her head that, well, I guess she knew that he needed to be charismatic. And I guess people have in their head of what charismatic looks like for them. And he definitely, like, her husband is very tall and classically good looking. And she and Lars is neither of those things. And yet, to my mind, there was still something very compelling about him. And she struggled to believe that he could be. I think that's interesting.
Yeah, I can see, you know, they're all, he's a personal trainer, I forgot to say that. So they're all drawn for their various reasons to look up to him. And he, so I can see why various members are attracted to him, taken in by him, and others a little more sceptical.
Yes, definitely. And as probably their kind of worst fears are born out, but, well, kind of.
Mm. Yeah, well, we can't give too much away.
No.
Megan?
No. No, exactly.
I'll leave it up to you to say as much or as little as you want to about the plot.
Well, this isn't exactly about the plot, but you mentioned when you were talking about the five different women that they're, apart from the two that already knew each other, that they are five very different women that are drawn together under the kind of their shared desire to get fit. And I think for me that was, and then just going back to what you were asking me about whether this was a book for our times, I think that is really what I'm getting at when I was kind of talking about the political versus the personal, because when I set out to write it, I was so kind of gobsmacked and fascinated by what we had lived through with COVID, where all these very, very different bedfellows, that people that I would have never expected to be on the same page about anything, were suddenly kind of all camping out at Parliament and protesting the vaccine mandates. And I found that, endlessly intriguing that that an issue could unify such diverse people like that. And it really kind of rocked me, I think, and made me question a lot of what I had assumed to be true about the world. Like, I grew up in a very left-leaning family, and my politics have always been very left. And I think I've kind of, even though supposedly if you're left, you're liberal and you're open-minded, I think in a kind of quite unattractive way, really, I had got quite closed-minded to that, you know, if you think one way, then you're going to kind of look a certain way. And I guess that was really what I wanted to explore, how we all got so polarized and how dangerous that is.
Yes, because as I said, four disparate women and coming for different reasons, and how our bodies, and other people's bodies can be put at risk, or we're so sensitive about how we see ourselves and how that whole thing has been shaped. So when you get those women together with this particular type of man, it becomes a fraught area, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does. I just actually was writing an essay yesterday to kind of promote the book coming out, and about body image. And I was doing a little bit of research, and it was so. I actually, by the end of it, I just felt utterly confused, because I was reading about all these kind of women that were very much poster girls for the body positivity movement, and so kind of a large woman who had embraced their size over the last 10 years and kind of basically said stuff you to everyone that tries to, the media and society that try and make them be small. But now with these kind of supposedly miracle weight loss drugs, Ozempic, etc., that are available, a lot of these women or people who have battled with their weight and kind of were at this stage of celebrating it are now actually choosing to lose weight because for the first time it seems possible for them, and they're getting this huge backlash from kind of other members of the body positivity movement who had celebrated them celebrating their weight, and they're like, and they now feel really ripped off. And so now these women are saying, well, hang on, no, the whole point of body positivity is that anyone should be able to be anything. So don't criticize us for now choosing a different path. And I was just, I thought, like, I don't know what I'm meant to think about all of this.
No, it's just bonkers, really. Things have been turned on their head by these new drugs. And, you know, it's interesting because it is part of our times now that, you know, I'm so much older. I feel very, very liberated that I didn't have to go to gyms when I was young. You know, we did feel pressure to be thin. That's never gone away. But I didn't have to put myself in a leotard or whatever the hell you call it. And meet up with friends or other women and, you know, feel so pressured to have my body on display in such a very overt way. That wasn't even a question. That was just my statement.
I totally get that and I envy you that, but I also feel like I've been a regular exerciser my entire, no, actually that's not true, not my entire life. I was like the kid at school that was the last to be chosen for the netball team, et cetera. And I grew up in this very creative, artistic family where it was kind of frowned upon to be interested in sports, and so I thought that that was what you did, like if you wanted to be arty then there was no way that you could be in any way physical. But then I don't know quite, I guess it was that pressure in my 20s to look a certain way. I started going to the gym, and although I've definitely gone through stages of really hating the gym and what it stood for, I have come to a good place in my relationship with gyms over the last 10 years. And I really, and there's a lot of thinking now around how important it is, particularly for women as we age, to be strong if you don't want to be taken out by a fall, or if you, you know, still want to be able to bend over and do your shoelaces up. And so I actually, although there's some real, that comes from my book, some really negative stuff, I think, around that pressure on women and body image. And I think hopefully there's also a little kind of glimpse that it can be something wonderful as well, and that there is something really, that really can lift your spirits about exercising in a group than in a way that I don't think anything else I've ever quite experienced does, perhaps, apart from maybe.
Yeah, well, yeah, and we can make this book sound very serious and dark, but and there are a lot of dark thoughts and possible, you know, you take us into some areas that we're all concerned about, the manosphere and all that evil stuff that's happening. But, you know, just to finish, let's say it's a lot of fun, this book.
Oh, thanks, Maureen.
And that sounds a bit glib, but...
No, but I'll the, take
that. You know, there's a lot of joy in the relationships between the women. You've had a great go at describing all these different types, not types of women, but different characters, and how they end up, you know, being their own saviours.
That's a really nice note to end on, because that was my hope for the book, that people would come away with it. A feeling that these women had, yeah, as you said, been their own saviours.
Well, I loved it. So thank you, Megan.
Aww, Another, thank you, Maureen. I think it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah. The book is called Other People's Bodies. It's by Megan Nicol Reed, and it's published by Allen and Unwin. And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.